Chair members of the committee, House Bill 2115A modifies the definitions that are applicable to the Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists that relates to licensing renewal and relicensing requirements.
Then we have Cheryl Fleming and John Deal. Board of Counselors and Therapists. Good morning. I'll let you go in whatever order you wish to proceed.
Chair Fisher, members of the committee, I'm Cheryl Fleming. I'm the administrator for the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors. With me is John Deal. He's our board chair. And we're here representing the board and appearing in support of House Bill 2115. Although the state law does not mandate the licensure of counselors and marriage and family therapists, as the agency, we're charged with regulating the practice of those who have chosen to and qualified for licensure. The board is proposing a number of changes to the existing licensing law, plus changes to two related statutes in an effort to clarify the obligations of the mental health service providers that we license. The handout we have provided summarizes the changes we are proposing and the reasons why we believe these are necessary, but I'd like to quickly go through them for you. We are adding a definition that creating records is part of the practice of counseling and therapy. We're establishing a two-year relicensing opportunity for those who let their license lapse. We've had a very unforgiving statute that once your license was gone, it was gone and you had to reapply under current statutes. About 90% of our licensees were grandparented, and we found that this was an extreme hardship for those who had inadvertently let this happen, and we have no mechanism to help them. We are providing a wider range of disciplinary sanctions that we can propose up front. Right now we have two, suspension and revocation, and in some cases we think that's a little harsh to start out with and does have a tendency to create a little bit of an overreaction. We do have civil penalty authority, and we are incorporating that into this specific provision. We're also trying to collect a mandated late renewal fee. The statute says we shall collect it, but or says we shall impose it, but we cannot collect it. So we are trying to change that part of the statute and put the burden of these additional services, the cost of those services, on the people who have forced us into that position. We are also asking to provide an exemption mechanism for our professional disclosure statements. This is at the request of some of the community mental health programs, some of the larger agencies that employ our counselors, who feel that the information just adds to the confusion of all the information that they have to provide to their clients. And we do believe that those agencies are taking responsibility for their employees, and we're hoping to work something out through rulemaking that will be in the best interest of both the people who get all of this paperwork and the people who have to provide it. One of the other things that we are doing is we are adding our licensees to the two lists of mandatory reporters of abuse to the people we feel are Oregon's most vulnerable citizens, the elderly, the mentally ill, and the developmentally disabled adults. Except for adding the relicensing provision, the board is not really trying to change the policy of the state to promote the profession or to expand the board's authority beyond what we believe was originally intended by the legislature. Overall, these amendments to the licensing law are to promote better understanding as well as enhance, or in a couple of cases, reduce regulatory activities to promote more efficient operations and effective operations of the board. The board identified these impediments to orderly, appropriate operations. We did hear confusion from our stakeholders, and we did listen to their frustrations, and we tried to address the majority of those frustrations through this bill. The Oregon Mental Health Alliance, which represents most of our licensees, and the academic community have supported this bill. Right now, we're unaware of any opposition to the bill in the form that it's being presented to you today, so we're asking that you send House Bill 2115, sent today in ghost, to the floor with the due task recommendation. And Mr. Dillon, I would be more than happy to answer any questions that you might have. And thank you for this opportunity to speak before you today.
Thank you. Further questions?
Seems straightforward to me.
We had a meeting in my office concerning the fact that there had been some proposed amendments and some other things that came up, and it looks like this will be something that we will pursue in the interim and the Health and Human Services Committee, hopefully a joint committee during the coming interim. We have Laura Smith here today. Bill, did you wish I want you to close
that? No, I didn't. Senator Fisher, I was just here to answer any questions that you may have, and it sounds like they understood that was a pretty straightforward proposal.
Okay, well then, why for Laura Smith?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Laura Smith here representing the Oregon Mental Health Counselors Alliance. I brought some printed testimony from the Alliance, so I'll go ahead and keep this real short. There's a couple of important issues that this bill addresses. One, it provides clarification of professional standards for the content of records, which affirms the therapeutic and treatment of counseling and therapy. That's real important for the counselors. Also, it's important the provision that allows those who miss the renewal deadline for various reasons, whether illness or whatever, that they'll have 2 years to renew with just a penalty, a fine. As it stands right now, if someone misses that deadline, they'll lose their license and are required to meet all the current required experience exam and experience requirements. This is one of the harshest and most punitive penalties in all the states, and it's really important that this be taken care of for the counselors. This AMGROS bill was a compromise bill that was acceptable to all interested parties in the House. I'd like to urge this committee to support this bill. Any questions?
No, but I would like to make a comment. I'm sorry I've been a little hard to get with, and I've had to rely on staff to contact you and try to keep me sorted out here, so I appreciate
that. That's okay. Understandable, and we're satisfied with the decision that you come to on taking care of several women. So, thank you.
All right, and thank you for the work that's been done in cooperation here on this. I'm going to close the public hearing now since we have no one else signed up to speak on House Bill 2115A, and open up the question on House Bill 2115A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2115A to the floor with a due task recommendation.
Senator Duncan moves House Bill 2115A to the Senate floor with a due task recommendation. Is there further discussion or objection? Hearing none, I will start call the roll.
Aye.
Senator Duncan?
Aye.
Senator Chung?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. And you need to carry. Senator Duncan would volunteer to carry the list, so I appreciate that, and we'll allow him to do that. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2115A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2581A. And we will collect the sign-up sheet for that momentarily. Senator Duncan, you may wish to use
the position of course, right?
It's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah. Right there.
That's an even better mark, though. Rinalda Dodson from the Oregon Health Division and Joan DeHoff from Marshall Fines and Governor's Maternity Task Force. Representative Pierce is here. Okay, staff is on its way. Good. I'd just begin your testimony here. We don't worry about what order.
Okay, thank you. Chairman Fisher and members of the committee, I'm Danelda Dodson, Assistant Administrator of the Oregon Health Division. I'm here to provide some information in support of House Bill 2581.
I'm very happy to be here today to support this bill because it is supportive of good public health policy. The boys are distributing, to an increased reliance on public insurance for the cost of maternity care and delivery. Access to health care is a major issue in ensuring a healthy population for a healthy community. This legislation fills a crucial gap in ensuring coverage of privately insured women to always include pregnancy care. House Bill 2581 closes the gap in benefits for women who may be otherwise insured but not covered for pregnancy-related services. In 1997, 61% of Oregon mothers had births that were paid for with private insurance, while a small portion, about 7%, paid the total cost of, from their own resources. The remaining births, or about 32%, were paid for with public dollars through Medicaid or the Oregon Health Plan. We know that the data does not adequately reflect those women who did not receive prenatal care due to uninsured status because the delivery can be covered by Medicaid, whereas the prenatal care cannot. And we do know that 13% of Oregon women are uninsured. Increasingly, single women, women of color, and teens are less likely to be privately insured for pregnancy, even though they may be employed in jobs that do have health benefits. Access to prenatal care ensures a healthy start for Oregon's children. We want to encourage Oregon insurers and employers throughout Oregon to cover the most basic preventive care for pregnant women. Uninsured women with poor financial access to prenatal care are far more likely to have a low birth weight baby. They have poor emotional and financial supports and are much more likely not to have the early prenatal care consistent with good prenatal care. Instead of a family welcoming a new baby, they are often overcome with the worry about the financial status of an uninsured pregnancy and birth. House Bill 2581 promotes the best public health interest for all Oregon's mothers and babies. Quite simply, it ensures that all women who are insured for the basic health care that includes pregnancy-related care. Thank you. Do you have any questions for me?
Joanne, do you have any questions? Good morning, Representative Cushing.
Good morning.
You made a quick trip, just come right on in. You're not too formal here.
Good morning. Nice to see you all. I want to thank you for hearing House Bill 2581. I think we've been very fortunate to have complete support on the House side for this bill. We have an opportunity today to send a piece of legislation to the Senate floor that's grounded in common sense and good public policy. It would require all health insurance policies in Oregon to provide maternity coverage for any member enrolled on a health plan. This bill is intended to assert that it is a state policy that all women who become pregnant are entitled to receive maternity health coverage from their private insurance plan. And I'd like to mention that when we talk about all women receiving insurance coverage for pregnancy, what we're really talking about is good prenatal care for babies that are being born, something that we're all very committed to in this legislature. Currently in Oregon, we're facilitating a system that provides maternity coverage for 95% of women covered by private insurance, but only guarantees maternity coverage for 52% of their dependent children. Attached to my testimony is a report required for all health insurance mandate bills that details coverage practices and policies of the major insurance companies in Oregon. I'd encourage you to read it. House Bill 2581 does two things. It mandates maternity coverage for all health insurance policies sold in Oregon, and it mandates that any enrolled member on that policy be extended maternity coverage. These amendments are in reaction to recent information I've received from health insurance representatives and the people who work with pregnant teens in Oregon. You may be surprised to learn that some insurance companies currently providing maternity coverage on policies sold in Oregon
would consider selling individual health insurance policies without any maternity coverage if they were required to cover dependent teens. That would have the unintended consequence of fewer pregnancies being covered by insurance. This AN Gross version that came out of the House solves this problem by preventing insurers from dropping pregnancy coverage and accomplishes our goal of providing maternity coverage for all enrolled dependents. We put two bills together to do this, and I think it has the support of everyone. Colleagues, the average cost of a term pregnancy with proper prenatal care and all associated costs in the United States has risen to well over $8,000 if there are no complications. While there is no way to qualify the financial hardship on each particular family for a lack of pregnancy coverage, we can speculate generally about the implications for dependent women and their families. Most often, these families don't know that their daughter's pregnancy will not be covered by their insurance provider, and therefore the families and the young women and their families are faced with three fates. They don't get prenatal care, which is bad for them and bad for the unborn child. They are forced to seek assistance under the Oregon Health Plan and Medicaid to pay for it and become emancipated in order to do that, so they are leaving the family that they should be with. And the family must find the family must find substantial resources to finance the cost of the pregnancy, which might mean that they don't get the prenatal care that they need. They don't get the services that they need to ensure good prenatal care and a healthy pregnancy. If a woman is denied coverage, that she still may not be covered by the Oregon Health Plan. If the young woman's family has income greater than 170% of the federal poverty level, she cannot stay at home and receive coverage. In order to obtain public assistance, she must leave her family and declare herself emancipated, as I said before. Let me be clear, it still has nothing to do with abortion. Neither is it an attempt to increase access to teen abortions. In fact, it has the opposite effect. It will ensure that people know that they can have pregnancy covered. This bill has no known opposition, passed the House floor 59-0. It affirms our responsibility as a legislature to ensure that all Oregonians receive the best basic health care coverage they pay for and deserve. And it's a great bill, and I would very much appreciate your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Chairman and committee members, my name is Joanne DeHoff, and I'm here today on behalf of the March of Dimes and the Governor's Maternity Task Force. I'm here in support of House Bill 2581, and I wanted to let you know that entry into prenatal care in the first 3 months of pregnancy is one of the most important factors relating to a good pregnancy outcome. We know that mothers who receive no prenatal care are nearly twice as likely to deliver a low birth weight baby or a very low birth weight baby. Prenatal care is designed to address health problems in the mother, such as infections, diabetes, high blood pressure, and poor weight gain. It's also an opportunity to address behaviors like alcohol use, tobacco use, other drug use, and is also a window to needed support services that will protect both the mother and the child. Poor birth outcomes, such as preventable birth defects, prematurity, low birth weight, cost Oregonians millions of dollars annually, and untold suffering to the families and the children. We know that every dollar spent on prenatal care saves $3.38 in neonatal intensive care costs for sick newborns. We do know that, and it is documented by the Institute of Medicine. The average lifetime medical cost for a premature child is conservatively set at $500,000. The lack of health insurance to cover pregnancy-related costs or an inability to pay for those costs out of pocket is recognized by the March of Dimes as a major barrier to full participation in prenatal care services. The women least likely to enter into prenatal care are women without health insurance, low-income women, and teenagers. House Bill 2581 is another step to ensuring that Oregon mothers have the opportunity to have a healthy pregnancy and to see that their newborns have a healthy birthday. Again, the March of Dimes and the Governor's Maternity Task Force urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both. You make such a great case for why we need to do this. And I wanted to especially thank Representative Piercy for her leadership on this issue. I know you've worked really hard on this for a couple of sessions or maybe more. And looks like we're finally going to do this, and it's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Peggy Annett and Bruce Bishop.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Anna, and I'm representing the Health Insurance Association of America. And I have today an amendment I would like to propose to House Bill 2581. As it turns out, the Health Insurance Association of America covers a variety of plans beyond which are just traditional medical plans. They include long-term disability, active-only plans, student health plans, which are short-term type of travel plans as well. And the issue that exists in the bill as it is presently drafted is that the limitation that you see in Section 2, Lines 7 and 8, is not expansive enough to exclude a number of other types of plans that are considered health plans for purposes of the insurance code. As healthcare reforms have evolved in Oregon, what has happened is that there's a very specific definition of what constitutes a health plan and what does not constitute a health plan. So the amendment that I am proposing will tie the definition of a health plan back to what is an existing statute. That happens to be in ORS 743-730. So as I would propose it, the language would read, all health benefit plans as defined in ORS 743-730 must provide payment or reimbursement for expenses associated with pregnancy care as defined by ORS 743-845-1B, sub 1, sub B, and childbirth. What happens as a result of this, then those other types of plans that are not what you would normally consider a health plan to cover pregnancy would be excluded as they are excluded in a whole host of excluded for legitimate reasons. And as I have suggested also, policies such as long-term disability, long-term care, credit health insurance, and a variety of such plans would be excluded under this definition.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
Why wasn't this picked up on the House side?
I happen to, Senator Shields, I was not here when the amendment was presented, and I looked at it, and I thought, I think the intention was to exclude those other types of plans. I think, though, what happened was, for whatever reason, the correct technical language was not picked up in the amendment that was presented.
Mr. Chair? So does this amendment narrow the plans that would be required to meet this new legislation?
It would, Senator Castillo, it would narrow it, but not inappropriately, in that the types of plans that would be explicitly excluded, as I mentioned, include not only the accident-specific disease, but disability income, coverage of Medicare services pursuant to contracts with the federal government, credit health insurance, long-term care, short-term health insurance plans, which generally are three-month policies, but they cannot, by statute, exceed 6 months, dental-only stop-loss policies. The problem that is created is that because Oregon has such a defined set, such defined language as what is a health plan and what is not a health plan, if you insert a new definition, ostensibly to limit plans that doesn't correspond with what already is in the insurance code, you create the problem of inserting these other policies because they're not explicitly excluded. And this is because of the history of the definitions that we already have in the code.
I'm trying to understand it too here. I'm looking at campus, maybe it's that because I was under campus for some time. Okay, if I were under campus, do we cannot make laws to affect that? Is that one of the factors?
Senator Fisher, Senator Duncan, yes, that is the case. The basic point is that in the definition of what is not statutorily now, what is not a health plan, it includes a variety of types of policies that you would not consider as a traditional health plan, which may be subject to the state insurance code. Also included in that definition of what does not constitute a health plan are those kinds of programs such as campus and ERISA subject plans, which we already know the state cannot regulate anyway.
Okay. We have no authority over Chiapas.
Correct. Another example of what does not constitute a health plan, for example, is the medical payment insurance under an auto policy. Those types of plans, as the bill is written, ostensibly would be covered because they're not explicitly exempted from the language. And it would raise the question, because there already are explicit definitions of what constitutes and what does not constitute a health plan in the code.
Yes, did you talk to Representative Christie about this at all?
I did, just very briefly.
I mean, we talked about two things. Right. I must admit to you that I don't have a feeling of real theory about this. When we talked about the other reason, I don't know whether prohibits coverage for something that should be reasonably covered.
Representative, would you come back up to the scene here a moment and put that on record, because my inclination is that there's some merit in this, and I would like to have it drawn up. We have time. I'd like to have it drawn up, and then it could be studied. And,
this is Representative Piercy. I've only had a few minutes to discuss this. It sounds reasonable to me, but I don't have a total feeling of security about that this won't limit coverage in some way that we've been trying to have coverage in this bill. So I would like to have a feeling of that security by having a chance to work on this enough so that we know that.
I'll direct staff to get the amendment.
Okay.
Thank you.
I was just wondering if the health division or anybody else had chance to look at this amendment, and if any of them might want to make comments or be involved with Representative Piercy, making sure that it covers what it needs.
They certainly have that opportunity, and using Representative Piercy up here this morning, I thought that that would represent the other side of the coin here, so that we have it on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, and I'm here representing Kaiser Permanente. Kaiser Permanente provides maternity coverage in all of its group and individual coverages. It does now, it has, and it will. This bill will not affect that. So I'm not here in support or opposition to those substantive provisions of the bill. I do want to address two issues that you've heard me talk about before concerning mandated benefits and the requirements of current state law. State law currently requires the proponents of new mandates to prepare a study on the social and financial impacts of those mandates. And I want to compliment the minority leader and her staff, particularly Morgan Allen, for complying with the spirit of those requirements and furnishing a report to the committee that explains what the consequences of this law will be. I think it is frankly, an unusual example of the proponents actually complying with those requirements for a study, and it should be applauded, because that helps give you as a legislative body more than anecdotal information on which to base your decision. Secondly, however, I would like to raise for your consideration line 10 on page 1 of the bill, which says the provisions of ORS 743.700 do not apply to this section. 743.700 is the other mandated benefit provision in existing law that provides for periodic review of mandated benefits 6 years after their enactment. The effect of RN10 is to take these provisions out of that periodic review requirement. I would urge the committee to remove line 10 from the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. I've got a response.
Which way do you want to go?
Senator Hsu.
When you say remove line 10 and the periodic review, that doesn't remove it from the law. That just requires that this be reviewed. What happens?
This would sunset with the removal of that line. This measure would sunset in 6 years, and the legislature would be enacted as it is required to do for all mandated benefits under current law.
It's not just the review, then it's a funds factor.
It is.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, I'd
like to know why. I mean, why do we need it on this one? I think there's pretty compelling evidence that this is needed. It's not going to cost insurance companies a lot of money. If anything, it's a good investment. I don't know why we would have to go through another review of this in 6 years. Why?
Mr. Mayor, Senator Castillo, I think in 6 years this will be a different legislative environment. It'll be a different millennium. Medical science may be different, and the health insurance market will certainly be different, and it's appropriate to review mandated benefits and probably all of the laws that are passed periodically to make sure that they're serving the needs that they were designed to do. Let me give you one specific example of the kinds of problems that can occur in this area, and they exist in our sister state to the north, Washington State now. They virtually have no individual market. People can't buy individual coverage, and if they can buy coverage, it doesn't have maternity benefits. That process started about 5 years ago with a series of health insurance reforms that were well-intentioned but have had the effect of eliminating coverage altogether. If we encountered those kinds of problems here, I think you would want the opportunity to review it. This provides for a method to do that periodically, and I don't think any law like this should be sacrosanct.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I may?
Okay.
Representative Jersey, I have been whispering back and forth here, and I am more than willing to take the word here that this is the First Amendment that was proposed as a technical fix, and that it doesn't affect the coverage of an insured, that it would not reduce any coverage that was intended in the original bill. So if you are of the mind to conceptually amend it so you can move it forward, I would be glad to tell you that I would be supportive of that.
Well, we are under the mandate
We've been doing a lot of it on our side. We do have time. I think this is a very simple thing to do, and so
I don't see any problem with this speeding through the process.
Okay.
And but I appreciate your willingness to look at all the initial gifts to everybody's chance to make sure.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, if I may add one additional word to Senator Castillo's question. Seems to me if the goal of the legislature is to exempt specific provisions like this from the law, that what you should do is repeal the law altogether.
I'd like to ask Senator Pearson for her reaction to the deletion of line 10 and maybe the health division and a few others for their reaction.
Say that again, please, Representative.
Whatever direction it comes from, I will restate the question. Would you react to Mr. Bishop's proposed amendment that we remove section, well, sub 2 there, under 2, line 10? Page 1, which puts the sunset in.
Well, I think my initial reaction to that is I don't see the necessity of it, and I definitely believe that we have the capacity to revisit this anytime we choose to revisit it.
Your little title reference here reminds me of an experience I had when I was first in the military. That search or sergeant, because I wasn't really sure what insignia meant. What? He said, "Don't search me. I work for a living."
Mr. Bishop was joking with me about getting my elevation and status, and so I just totally lost it and called him a representative. But it's all fine.
You could be going with a great team.
You know, it's interesting because. Going back in the history of this mandate, deal. I think probably my colleagues up here that are rearing up the questions could go back into their respective caucuses and find out why this was done at a time when there was a different majority leadership in the legislature. And I don't think that myself that it hurts the review because I do think that things change. And what Mr. Bishop brought up has been one thing that I've been very concerned about all the way along with mandates is the fact that we make insurance policies out of reach and we destroy the opportunities for our people to have access to anything at all. Because that very thing of what we did when we excluded all the exceptions for changing rates with insurance was effectively denied my daughter insurance. Mm-hmm. When she went off of my policy, she was denied insurance on the basis she was overweight without even any kind of a physical exam or even talking to her and calling to check in with her personally. They just have some kind of a weight chart that they go by, and they just sent back and said, we're not interested. And otherwise, she probably could have been quoted, say, maybe had to pay $10 a month more or $15 a month more or something, which might well be reasonable under the circumstances. But instead, was absolutely denied insurance, period, because of the way the law was written and what the insurance company was disallowed to be able to do. And for whatever merits they use in choosing that kind of a basis to deny, I'm not here to discuss the merits of that, but we live in a real world, and that's exactly what happened. And so I would sooner see access to some things with a little flexibility and somebody being able to pick and choose. Mm-hmm. We do that in so many other instances. We can require this and that, you know, the driver's license or something like this and put standards on there. We still allow people to drive, but they may not be able to drive at night and you have to have glasses and, you know, this type of thing. And they may not be able to drive if they're under certain medications. And yet we don't deny the thing totally. And so when we get too hard bound and using force as a means of accomplishing something, oftentimes we have a tendency to defeat our own purpose.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. On this particular mandate, Taylor, or the laws about mandates that we have in our state, I think sometimes it's very frustrating because they are so inflexible, treating all mandates the same, and I don't believe that all mandates result in the same outcome, and definitely this is one that will not drive up costs. It's very cost effective, but we probably will see some very positive benefits as a result of this one. I don't see that this one warrants the same requirements that maybe other mandates that very clearly may add to the cost of insurance premiums, even though maybe they do also provide very positive benefits. This is one that clearly will not drive up costs, and I think that to put it, have the same requirements as other mandates. I guess that's what frustrates me about the requirements that we have for insurance mandates, that they're all treated the same, and they're not all the same. They don't net the same results, right? So that's, I guess, the frustration with this one and the periodic review requirement on this one.
Well, 6 years is a long time, and it's not, it certainly doesn't preclude continuing on beyond that. It merely brings it up for a discussion again and a review, and I guess I don't know of one mandate, basically, that's been dropped because of the 6-year review. Peggy, are you aware of any mandate that's been dropped because of the 6-year review?
Mr. Chair, I should have left the podium. There have been some mandates that are no longer applied. The one that comes to mind immediately is the diabetes self-management education mandate that is no longer required. Interestingly enough, even the person who is the strongest advocate of the bill after it was enacted had told me personally that he wished that he would have focused on another aspect of diabetes as opposed to the self-education, but irrespective of his view of that, no plan that I know of has dropped the diabetes self-management education.
If it has been, a mandate has been dropped, it certainly hasn't raised any kind of a protest that I've caught as far as the legislative view. And again, we've had a review of the mammography and the pap smear mandates, and it certainly appears that they will be continued. And I'm not certain that the discussion and the get together was totally harmful. It might even resulted in a bit more concern about those things, and bringing them back into the public eye, and making more women aware of it, that they'll go out and take care of themselves better. And I know I have to kind of push my wife to make sure that she continues to get hers, and she'll mention that she ought to be doing it, and then I kind of insist that she does, and eventually gets done. But
you do all your tests you're supposed to get over, Mr. Chair.
Pretty close.
Mr. Chair, if I may, just one more observation on the diabetes self-management. It's actually probably a good example of why things should be either repealed or periodically reviewed, because over the six-year period of time, that benefit evolved into something that was very much different than what was initially envisioned. In fact, it came to mean something more encompassing, and that is basic nutrition for people who have diabetes, which ended up being a more significant form of education than what was included in the original proposal.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Chief.
Whichever way you look at it, I have a question. If there is nothing with or without a sunset that would prohibit us from going back and looking at something if medical science changes. Is that not true?
Well, it makes it harder probably because it doesn't bring it up automatically. And I think something about this particular provision that I kind of like, it allows something to stay long enough that you have a chance to work it and see how it works, because there's nothing that says you can't bring it up just because it sunsets and say, use this, meaning that you couldn't bring it up and stop it before that time either. So the mandate doesn't rule that out.
Mr. Chair, my concern is that the bill passes.
Yeah. I don't have anybody else listed. No. I would be glad to entertain we have a little bit of time left if somebody else here wishes to testify on it, or if the Health Division or anybody wishes to enter in a bit into the conversation. Why don't we have both amendments drawn up, and as soon as we can get them, we'll have another hearing and go ahead and hold a work session then, and have folks have a time to think it over and look at things. And sure. Lynn Parton has delivered a letter here testifying in favor of House Bill 2581, and we're going to go ahead and read that into our record here. That's the only other information that we've had presented to us here. Well, thank everybody for coming today. I have no further things before the committee, and we'll look forward to getting this back up as quickly as possible. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2581A and adjourn the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services.